It's time for Dialogue Conspiracy with political research specialist Mae Brussel, who for 3 years has shared with us her decades' research into political assassinations and abuses of power in this country. Her program relates the news of the week to emerging evidence about the conspiracy which allegedly maintains by force its control over the legislative and judicial processes in America. And now, here's Mae.
Good afternoon. This is Mae Brussel, Carmel, California. This is Dialogue Conspiracy number 211. It's August 25th, 1975. I have a lot of new information or names in the news that you've heard before. The Howard Hughes lawsuit in New York, I want to bring up. The investigation of the Robert Kennedy assassination in Los Angeles, which is proceeding in spite of the fact of all this massive evidence being destroyed down by the police department at the present time. George Wallace asking for a new investigation. And today the Kopechne family had misgivings about not having an autopsy on Mary Jo because she was asleep in back of the car and they should have had an autopsy on her. I thought we'd jump around today on these various news items and also the SLA story. A new agent provocateur, an agent of the FBI, has surfaced by the name of Don Gray, a nephew of Patrick Gray, who was former head of the FBI at the time that the Watergate, he was the head of the FBI and then resigned, and Mr. Saxby then became the head. But Donald Gray is a nephew of Patrick Gray, and he claims that he worked for the FBI and that they shot Donald DeFries, not the Los Angeles Police Department, that Don Gray shot him. And a lot of the lead stories that I had in the news in the past few years are breaking all at one time and practically one day. And I open my morning paper. I don't know whether to be satisfied or frustrated or confused to see all this pouring out at one time. A lot of these programs have to be followed up with information or reading material. And I haven't spent much time the last few weeks. We've raced along at such a fast speed that I do want to tell you about some literature that you can obtain as backup to these programs. And if we go too fast, again, with the addresses, write to me at KLRB, and I'll give you the name of the authors of the books or the articles in whatever area you're interested in. And I will have new bibliographies made up shortly. I have to, because there's so much new material coming out, and the bibliographies that I give when I lecture or mail out to people who write to me are books that are almost out of print now, some of them out of print, but there are new books coming out, and they're excellent, and there's some new articles on the stands about the assassinations. There is one new book called Presumed Guilty by Howard Rothman, and you might ask your libraries to order these books because they're expensive. This book is $12. It's about Lee Harvey Oswald and the assassination of President Kennedy, published by the Associated University Press, Cranberry, New Jersey, 08512, Presumed Guilty. The first section goes into the presumption of guilt by the National Press, of course, then by the Warren Commission. There was an article in New Times just last month on the role of the New York Times in keeping the conspiracy of John Kennedy away from the truth, directing it towards that lone assassin theory, which doesn't hold weight compared to the evidence. The first section of Rothman's book is on the presumption of guilt from the very start of the Warren Commission and the National Press. The second section is about the medical and ballistic evidence that there were many guns and crossfire and that it wasn't one person standing at the window at the book depository. And the third part of this book is about the rifle in the building, about Oswald at the Texas School Book Depository, Oswald's actions after the shots, and Oswald's rifle capability. It's a good book. He's a history teacher or a history student, young person, Howard Rothman. He spent a lot of time. He's got a lot of references. And if you're interested in the presumption of guilt and the evidence that Oswald didn't do it alone, I think it's an excellent book. And as they say, the title is Presumed Guilty by Howard Rothman. And it's $12, Associated University Press. Then another book came out this last couple of weeks, called Coup d'etat in America. And the way the format of John Kennedy, then it's CIA, spelled with the big letters of the coup in America, by A.J. Weberman and Michael Canfield. And this is $12 also. The Third Press Special, 444 Central Park West, New York, New York, 10025. Coup d'etat in America. And these young persons, I don't know Mr. Canfield, I've met A.J. Weberman, talked to him on the phone many times. They are young, and they put together a very impressive book. I have over 110 books on the John Kennedy assassination, but I would rank this as a terribly important now book. It's a very good book because it's more up-to-date about the motives of why John Kennedy was killed and pressuring the reasons and placing the people who had motive to kill him in being in a position to kill him. They have a section called How It All Began. They have another section on the motive for killing John Kennedy, and then these same people had the motive was interrelated to the Robert Kennedy assassination later, although this is about John Kennedy. There's a section called Was Oswald a CIA Agent? But it's terribly important because this book is the first one on the John Kennedy assassination to link E. Howard Hunt and Manuel R. Time and members from the Bay of Pigs operation to the Dallas assassination of John Kennedy and then to the Watergate to see the historical links of persons going all the way from, as Richard Nixon said when the Watergate case broke on his White House tapes, he said, this will get us in trouble. We have to pay E. Howard Hunt. It goes all the way back to the Bay of Pigs. And in that interim between Watergate and Bay of Pigs, there's the John Kennedy assassination, the Robert Kennedy, and the Martin Luther King. And this book carries the links of E. Howard Hunt from Bay of Pigs up to Watergate. It has the links of Jack Ruby to organized crime in Chicago, to the military, a military colonel, to the FBI, to Richard Nixon, and by his role in the Internal Security Committee. It covers Jack Ruby's links. It covers the links of Richard Nixon to the Bay of Pigs, his role as vice president, the people he worked with in the late 50s, and organized crime. Use the links of Nixon to Howard Hughes, to the CIA and the organized crime, that interrelationship there. It goes into B.B. Rebozo and George Smathers and their links to organized crime and to the John Kennedy assassination, Frank Sturgis, his role and his being investigated by the Warren Commission, not by them, but by the FBI immediately after the assassination of John Kennedy, and saying that if one man could have done it, he was capable of doing it. And Sturgis talks about the approachment to him to be on assassination teams. He worked with Bernard Barger and E. Howard Hunt. And it's a very, very good book. I'm terribly impressed with this book. There's some very gross errors in the book, but they're very minor. Luckily, the gross errors have no footnotes because they don't exist. But what the book has is, for every chapter, maybe almost 100 footnotes. It reminded me of the work that I did for The Realist, the three articles, where I took a lot of time and gave footnotes so that people could look it up for themselves. And the major contribution is hundreds and hundreds of footnotes to look up quotations and placement of people at certain times and certain positions. And a upfront, straightforward accumulation of evidence. I was terribly impressed with the book, and I think that everybody who studies the various conspiracies would find this an extremely exciting and interesting book. I don't like to take it apart on the discrepancies because they're minor. They haven't dwelled or researched on them, so they come to conclusions. But the major part of it is really good. It's called Coup d'etat in America by A.J. Weberman and Michael Canfield, and every student of assassination should read this important book. And you can order back issues from National Tatler, particularly the June 8th issue, 1975, on the John Kennedy assassination. And they have one November 1972 on John Kennedy and June 8th, 1975, on the Robert Kennedy. You should have these issues. They're very good, and they're filled with information. And George Wallace came out. We'll go into that a little more later in the program if I have time. He doesn't believe that Arthur Bremer was the lone gunman in Maryland, and he wants this case opened up. There is a good book, small book, put out by Frank Salant, S-A-L-A-N-T. This is just hand-runoff mimeographed, and it's $6. Who Shot George Wallace? And it's his address is 48 Parker Boulevard, Monsey, New York, 10952. And that's a very good book on the George Wallace. There's one more book that comes out of Salt Lake City called Mormon, Shadow or Reality by Gerald and Sandra Tanner. Put out in 1972 at $6.95, Modern Microfilm Company, Box 1884, Salt Lake City, Utah, 84110. You can write to me about those addresses if you need them. Shadow or Reality, a very good explanation of the Mormon Church and the position of the Mormon Mafia around the alleged living Howard Hughes. He isn't alive. Can be explained more fully, the power structure and the way power manipulates, if you order this very extensive and thorough book on the philosophy, the political philosophy of the Mormon Church, and then extend it further and get more articles on the data banks and the compilation of information about everyone circling this earth on this earth that is none of their business to keep track of. You have to begin to think in the future of who is collecting this information on us and how do they get their power. And this book on the Mormon Church is excellent. One other address, the crime bill, this was John Mitchell and Richard Nixon's crime bill to stop this kind of investigative research and to make it a federal crime to divulge this information, which the government marks top secret. This primer for the police state can be ordered from Lindsay Auden, A-U-D-I-N, 169 Main Street, Ossining, New York. If you send him 50 cents, he'll send you a primer on the emerging police state. If you send him another 25 cents, he'll send you an organizational contact list, 32 organizations that are fighting the police state. And if you send $5, he'll give you an analysis of the LEAA and new articles on nuclear power and design for a free society. Lindsay Auden, A-U-D-I-N, 169 Main Street, Ossining, New York, 10562. It just stands to reason as more people begin to do their investigative work on these various assassinations and conspiracies, the government has to counteract with something to lock them up, and the crime bill would be that bill, and it's very important to keep the flow of information going. This week, Richard Nixon said that it wasn't time to make the full disclosure of Watergate, and that he will determine, and not Congress, when it is appropriate for this to be exposed, this information that he has. And Richard Nixon went on to make it clear that any disclosure on his part, I'm reading a quote, would come only after his personal review of the material and that he will consider whether it is national security problem, end quotes. Now, that is exactly the problem that came up when John Kennedy was assassinated. Earl Warren, the Chief Justice, and Lyndon Johnson, the President of the United States, decided that for national security, we wouldn't have the story of the assassination for 75 years. And now, after Watergate and with reopening of these many cases and trials, you can see that it's utmost importance that we open these things now. I have a few more addresses for you, but I won't put too many on. I'll do some more next week if you're interested in ordering material and documents to read in addition to this brief 45-minute news count. We can't go into sources of information, but there are researchers like myself all around the country, and they are publishing information, and you can get it and become informed. College is opening up the next week. MPC opened up here last week, and you can spread the word around about my research. And those of you that are here going away to college next week and listen regularly, I get calls, some of you are leaving. You can ask the lecture bureaus at your college to have me speak there. The best way, the only way I can support myself in this research is by writing articles or a book or lecturing. And the material, the information is coming in so fast, it's hard to get out published articles, but I can go away for a day or two each month and give one or two lectures and come back. And that amount of lecturing allows me to continue the research at the pace I'm going. So those of you that are away at college or leaving soon to go away, put in a word. And for those of you that receive the show in other cities, make arrangements with the lecture bureau, and maybe I can come speak to you, and through these lectures, I can continue this research. The news last week, we talked about the Howard Hughes suit, about two stockholders in New York City that have filed a suit against the Summa Corporation. Victor and Ellen Kurtz, stockholders, have claimed that Hughes is fraudulently reported to be alive. They believe he is not alive, and they want the court to get an administrator and find out if Hughes is alive or dead, and if the Hughes Corporation is being used for profit and power over our lives. And I have contact with these people, would like to work with them and give them my information that Howard Hughes is dead. In the last years, I've been studying the Hughes case, and every week I get more and more intrigued with it. And there's some research that I would like to share with you about the person who's supposed to be in the Bahamas. When Robert Kennedy was in the Congress before he became the Attorney General, he was investigating organized crime and held hearings in the Congress against organized crime. And at that time, Edward Long, a senator from Missouri, decided that Robert Kennedy may be abusing the poor syndicate of organized crime. So he hired two attorneys to put a lid on Robert Kennedy and see how Robert Kennedy ganged up against the gangsters. And the two attorneys that he hired to come down on Robert Kennedy and investigate him going into the organized crime field were Bernard Fensterwald and Roy Cohn. Now, Bernard Fensterwald's name comes up because as soon as Robert Kennedy was dead, Bernard Fensterwald formed a committee to investigate assassinations. And that committee was funded by James McCord. I may read you more of the chain of command next week. James McCord of the CIA was funding Bernard Fensterwald's committee to investigate assassinations, which was formed after John Kennedy and Robert Kennedy were killed. But after the congressional investigations of Robert Kennedy into organized crime, which he was starting as the Attorney General, he went farther into this and wanted to launch a campaign in 1961 against the National Crime Syndicate. There were three people on his committee that were supposed to get people like Jimmy Hoffa, whose name you hear in the news a lot. He is gone right now, but I won't talk about Hoffa today. The main point is that Robert Kennedy in the Justice Department set up a committee, and he was seriously going after the National Crime Syndicate. Now, the three people that he had on his committee, one of them was William Hunley, the other was Robert Peliquin, and the third one was William Bittman. At the time of the Watergate, these men surfaced again from Dallas to Watergate. These names keep coming through. Bittman was the attorney for E. Howard Hunt. He's the lawyer that was handling the secret money for the Cuban Committee. He collected hush money. He should have been prosecuted for the obstruction of justice. And Bittman represented E. Howard Hunt at the time that Hunt represented the Hughes interests at Mullen Associates and CIA and White House at the same time. The other attorney in the Justice Department was William Hunley, who turns out to be John Mitchell's attorney at the time of Watergate, and Robert Peliquin, who left the Justice Department in 1970, along with Mr. Hunley, to form Intertel. Now, Intertel is the organization that was set up by former people of the Justice Department, who Robert Kennedy evidently had trusted, who later took over the gaming interests that belonged. They were bought up by the Hughes Corporation. Intertel came in and tried to move the hard mafia out and take the crime level to another stage, which I call the CIA drug traffic, the international drug traffic. And Mr. Hunley, Robert Peliquin, and William Bittman, the very men that Robert Kennedy had wanted to use to break the National Crime Syndicate, show up in the Bahamas at Paradise Island and are working together and surface as a team. It's 72 representing John Mitchell, representing the Hughes interests, Intertel, the Hughes interests, and E. Howard Hunt. After Fensterwald got off of Robert Kennedy's back and Robert Kennedy was killed, as I say, he formed the Committee to Investigate Assassinations and was funded by James McCord through a Mr. Lew Russell, who I have mentioned before on this program, who died shortly after the Watergate story broke, and Russell had worked for Robert Mayhew and Richard Nixon in the House on American Activities. It was Lew Russell who helped with Whitaker Chambers in prosecuting so-called communists. And these people that have control of the Hughes empire, very much in control, splintered off from the Justice Department, and evidently Robert Kennedy had made the mistake of trusting these people, and now they're very much linked to the organized crime syndicate that they were supposed to be investigating. James Neal, also a Watergate prosecutor, was part of the RFK Get Hoffa squad, who surfaced to be part of that secret team also. Another interesting thing is that Bernard Fensterwald, while he was funded by James McCord in the CIA, was working with Robert Kaiser and is very close to Robert Kaiser. And Kaiser wrote the book RFK Must Die, and he based it on a phony book that Oswald didn't write that I've accused E. Howard Hunt of writing, and other people have mentioned the possibility that Hunt wrote all of these famous diaries of Arthur Bremer. and RFK must die and Oswald's diary, and that, yeah, it has to be determined who wrote those diaries, because those men, the alleged assassins, didn't write them. But Robert Kaiser, who was alone with Sirhan for hours before the police came, who worked for Rand Corporation and Henry Luce and Life magazine, is very thick with Bernard Finsterwald, who, and James McCord, and you see the pattern there of how the committee to investigate assassinations was put into the hands of those persons who had the power to open the thing up because they were part of it. And this explains all the discrepancies in the behavior of Mr. Finsterwald, who's been accused for years of being a member of the Central Intelligence Agency. Now, the news is breaking about the second gun. The evidence in Los Angeles is being destroyed right and left. It's very much like the Watergate when the men were arrested. E. Howard Hunt's desk was cleared out. Boxes were cleared out. The safe was cleared out. The Patrick Gray, the acting head of the FBI, was to dip Deep Six material. The offices of CREEP had machines come in to destroy the papers. This frantic removal of all the evidence, the Watergate must have been taking place in the Los Angeles Police Department for quite a while, probably since Ted Schirake made the fantastic movie The Second Gun. The editor, Harry Farrell of the San Jose Mercury, had an editorial today, "Did the Second Gun Kill RFK?" And he said that he was skeptical all these years, and he was in his editorials, but he said, "I'm now reexamining my skepticism." And he's glad that the judge in Los Angeles opened the case, and he mentioned a well-known criminalist who's going to be helping CBS prosecute this case or open up to get the evidence. But there won't be much evidence left when they get to it. The Senate committee investigating the CIA, pertinent to the second gun in Los Angeles, and not a part, I'm sure, is looking into the relationship of the Los Angeles Police Department to the Central Intelligence Agency. Well, that's what I've been calling Watergate West, for those of you that listen to KLRB and Dialogue Conspiracy. There's a Times, LA Times story this week. A Senate committee investigating the CIA has expanded its probe to cover intelligence gathering operations of police departments across the country, and it has encountered a rebuff from Los Angeles Police Chief Ed Davis. This is a quote: "It will be a cold day in hell when I provide you with the information that you've requested." He told the Washington committee to go back and mind their own business, that these intelligence operations are important, and that the suggestion is that he didn't intend to provide Congress with information, because they should take care of their own affairs, and that he would take care of local affairs. There was an amended report in the newspaper today that the committee in Washington has bypassed Ed Davis and asked the police commissioners for information on intelligence gathering since 1965. They've asked, there's somewhat of an apologetic tone from the chief of police, Ed Davis, with reference to, "It would be a cold day in hell before he'd give information." Ed Davis says, "I didn't say that I apologize, but go to the Los Angeles Police Commissioner for the information." The committee in Washington is seeking, in quotes, "wide-ranging information from 11 U.S. metropolitan police departments." They said the issue has to be resolved. Are local police being used by the CIA to get around limitations imposed on the CIA activities? Now, that is very important, and this is what was asked by Congress, by Senator Church's committee. The issue is, are local police being used by the CIA to get around the limitations imposed on CIA activities? Davis found the request for his information he called incredible, and he had a quotation, "I would suggest that you stick your nose back in your own tent." Well, the allegations of Lewis Tackwood from the Los Angeles Police Department are reason enough to open up the links of Washington, D.C. to the Los Angeles Police Department. There are other reasons to open it up. The Robert Kennedy assassination, in which Chief of Police Ed Davis, then D.A. Evel Younger, who's now Attorney General of California, and Chief of Detective Robert Houghton, have concealed information on the assassination of a senator. It isn't local business at all. It isn't Los Angeles business that they should tend to in Los Angeles. And Washington take care of its Washington business. The shootout and the murder at the Ambassador Hotel took away a candidate for the President of the United States. I came in the studio today, and I read a news report that one quarter of all black persons are unemployed in the United States today. Those that could be employed, one quarter of them are out of employment totally. They're being dropped out of the job market. We have an appointed president now who favors armament and armament budgets against domestic programs, and having a candidate elected who would change a course of events is a very important matter. It's not a local matter, no matter what Ed Davis says. The Los Angeles Police Department has been brought up in the defense of a gentleman, the San Quentin 6 trial up in Marin County that's taking place now. Members of the Los Angeles Police Department were part of the murder of George Jackson, the shootout, the part of the Judge Haley shootout where he was killed and others were killed in Marin County. The LAPD was behind the creation of Donald DeFries, along with the FBI and CIA, and the SWAT activities that murdered 6 members of the SLA before the true story could be told. Now, Ed Davis should be called before Congress, and so should Louis Tackwood, because Tackwood alleged that there were planned violences for San Diego, and later when Watergate broke, there were planned violence and demonstrations for Miami. Tackwood claimed that there were plans to kill Richard Nixon at the time of the San Diego conventions when it was moved to Miami, and Andrew Topping was arrested in New York, and this was hushed up, and Topping was on the payroll since 1966 of the Pentagon. Louis Tackwood said that there were $10 million of a secret fund that was sent around violence and provocations for the convention in San Diego. And when Watergate broke, there was a $10 million secret fund through 90 dummy fronts, used money sent to Bennett, to Mr. Robert Bennett and Mullen Associates. Louis Tackwood said the names that he was to call in Washington, D.C. at the time of the riots or martial law were Mr. Martin and Mr. White. And the name Martin and White comes out when James McCord was arrested. His name was given as Mr. Martin, and E. Howard Hunt was given as White. Now, this is not new information for people that listen regularly on KLRB, but we do have new listeners, and some of them haven't read my realist article on why Martha Mitchell was kidnapped. And sometimes we have to go into the old to tie it to the present to show the insidiousness of the police conspiracy. And last but not least, as an example of the Los Angeles Police Department working with the CIA, I want to mention the Dr. Lewis Fielding operation because I've had Elmer Davis on my program many times, and I've done radio shows with him, and he's down in Los Angeles at the present time. Elmer Davis was named as having burglarized Dr. Lewis Fielding's offices in Beverly Hills. He never was in the office. He was asked to confess to some crimes in Beverly that he didn't know anything about in Beverly Hills, and he didn't confess to them, and he was put into Folsom Prison. He was put in jail, and his parole was revoked because of a charge which he believed was trumped up at the time, and he was at Folsom Prison in 1973 when the Ellsberg trial was going, and he realized that the charges that they wanted him to confess, included the Dr. Lewis Fielding burglary, but they weren't listed, and he had turned them all down, and the Beverly Hills Police Department, rather, forged documents, undated, unsigned, and said that he confessed to the Dr. Lewis Fielding offices. Well, a $2 million lawsuit, pro per, he's handling it himself, was placed in 1973. This suit is going on in Los Angeles every month. They meet in September 23rd. There's another hearing of the Beverly Hills Police Department, and G. Gordon Liddy, I believe, will lose as default. The defendants are G. Gordon Liddy, E. Howard Hunt, John Ehrlichman, and Egil Crow, and 3 Beverly Hills police officers for creating the Plumber unit and for finding a patsy to cover their act so that the CIA would not be investigated for any possible burglary in Beverly Hills. Well, the Rockefeller report came out. I don't know how many of you have it. I bought it at the government printing office. The Rockefeller report investigates domestic CIA activities came out. And of all things, they have in there the break-in of Dr. Lewis Fielding's office, page 187 to page 190. And in the Rockefeller report, they talk about Elmer Davis on page 188. And they describe the 3 Cuban emigres on September 3rd, 71, who went to Dr. Fielding's offices, and that Hunt and Liddy had previously reconnoitered the Fielding offices, and Egil Crow and Mr. Young set up the plumber operation. It was authorized by Mr. Ehrlichman. Bernard Barker, Rolando Martinez, and Philippe de Diego were in the operation. Now, the Rockefeller Report has this to say, and this is a direct quote, page 188. And this report has to do with a case pending right now in the courts in Los Angeles, and they wrote this in their report. Shortly after the break-in, the Los Angeles police picked up one Elmer Davis, who was wanted on several charges. In return for the dismissal of other charges, he pleaded guilty to the Fielding burglary, although there is no evidence he had any part in it. The office was left in shambles to cover the group's tracks by making it appear that someone looking for drugs had broken in it. As a result, the burglary received no publicity, and it was not until John Dean and Hunt testified in April 73 that the facts of the operation came to light. I spoke to a judge living on the peninsula here last night and asked him if this gives Elmer Davis the case. When the government prints a conclusion of a case that's pending in court, it isn't much different than bargaining with Judge Byrne, when the Ellsberg trial was going, offering him to be head of the FBI when they were prosecuting Daniel Ellsberg. When the government comes to a conclusion, an investigative body like the Rockefeller Committee came to the conclusion that Elmer Davis pleaded guilty when he has a $2 million lawsuit that's been moving up every stage in the courts for the last 2 years, and they've printed the conclusion in there, but they lost themselves in one of the tracks. They said the Los Angeles police picked him up, and he was wanted on several charges. It was the Beverly Hills police that picked Elmer Davis up when he was in Beverly Hills and said, would you plead to these for 35 burglaries on Beverly Hills? We want to clean the book. And when he said no, they said, well, we have to charge you anyway, and picked him up. Now, in his conspiracy trial, he's arguing the links of Howard Hunt and G. Gordon Liddy and James McCord working with Lewis Tackwood on Squad 19 and working with the Los Angeles Police Department. So in the Rockefeller report they have printed about the LAPD role when it actually was the Beverly Hills Police. So now Elmer Davis should be able to subpoena the report from the Rockefeller Commission and ask on what basis they have that the LAPD was looking for him. He had become pro per and had sued the LAPD and was working for the Public Defender's Office in Long Beach. And Elmer Davis felt that he had been selected as the patsy, first because he did have a long list of drug use for 20 years until 1966 and had been in programs and had not taken drugs since 66, but he had a long record so that the throwing of the drugs around would make it look like a former or a current narcotic addict would be throwing these drugs, looking for drugs. Now, it would be silly if there were drugs to leave them around. A narcotic addict would pick them up if he found something that looked like drugs, so they wouldn't suspect a narcotic addict. But the point is that the Rockefeller Commission has used the Los Angeles Police Department as being involved, and Elmer knows that they were involved, but now he can subpoena those papers, hopefully, and find the link of conspiracy closer. So it's no wonder that Ed Davis is bucking against the Senate committee. And furthermore, Elmer had written, when he was still in Carmel, and written to the church committee, had written to the Rockefeller Committee to come and testify of the links of the Central Intelligence Agency to the local police department as evidenced in that terrible conspiracy they did against him. And he got letters where we'll let you know if you can testify. And the Rockefeller Committee not only didn't invite him to give his version of what happened at the Dr. Lewis Fielding, every defendant in the case who could provide information, every person, was a defendant in the case. And if the LAPD provided the information, that makes the conspiracy worse because it concerned the Beverly Hills Police and had nothing to do with the Los Angeles Police Department at all. So when Ed Davis says it would be a cold day in hell before he would provide information to the committee, and he asked the police commissioners to do it or bypasses his responsibility, he means that he doesn't want to get farther into this quagmire. But eventually, they can cover and cover and cover only so long, and these stories will break. And I hope the Elmer Davis story, the Robert Kennedy story, and other areas of the Los Angeles Police Department, the Tackwood allegations, the Squad 19, the Marin County shootout, they should all break before the trial is over, the San Quentin Six, and show the role of the Los Angeles Police Department in creating violence in the California prisons as an excuse to tighten up the prisons and tighten up the visiting and the political power of people like George Jackson. It's all so silly because if George Jackson were out and he was writing bestseller books, he would be like Eldridge Cleaver, who's praising the American military at the present time and turning a capitalist while he's designing men's clothing. And if they just let George Jackson out, like they're letting a lot of people out now, they wouldn't have needed all these conspiracies. These conspiracies are expensive in terms of life, in terms of energy, and in cover-up, and court appeals, and destruction of evidence, and new investigations. And Ed Davis and Evel Younger from our state should certainly be thoroughly investigated for the creation of the SLA, the murder of Robert Kennedy, and the Squad 19, the links to Watergate to Washington, D.C., because, as Louis Tackwood said in 1971, the LAPD and CIA are heavily linked, and they're linked to Houston, Texas. That's why Thurl Wheeler of the SLA is back in Texas, and is one of the reasons why Charles Watson of the Manson murders came from Texas and was protected in Texas so he could get a separate trial apart from Charles Manson. And this is why a woman who brought a tape recorder into the prison the day that George Jackson was killed ran right off to Houston, Texas. Louis Tackwood said there was a link to Houston and to Washington, D.C., the CIA, directly to the LAPD. Those of you that listen to these shows could write to the Church Committee about this information and back up what I'm saying to what they're investigating and support their pressure on Chief of Police Davis and not have another whitewash. Now about the SLA, again, we're getting into the area of the LAPD. A press conference was held this last week, and a gentleman by the name of Wayne Lewis claims that he was an undercover agent for the FBI and that he was charged in an LA press conference that the FBI infiltrated the SLA. Specifically, Lewis charged that Donald DeFries was an FBI informer, that DeFries was killed by an FBI agent, not by members of the Los Angeles Police Department SWAT squad. That would explain why DeFries' head went to some area, I don't know whether it's thrown in the garbage can or where his body was sent, back to Ohio without his head. Maybe the ballistics of his head would show that he was killed by a bullet different than the SWAT team. The ballistics show that there was a different bullet than the ordinary one used by the police department. And this gentleman, Mr. Lewis, claims that the man who specifically shot Donald DeFries was not a member of the regular SWAT team, that he was assigned to do it. He said the SWAT, the FBI actually tried to replace DeFries with another leader. They wanted Lewis to do it. And the FBI is currently under investigation for other involvement in guerrilla groups that they have infiltrated, and they're very active part of it, both as informers and that they are encouraging these guerrilla groups. There's a claim here that the FBI knows where Patty Hearst is now, but they let her remain free so that the agency can build wide-ranging files on potential subversives. Does that sound familiar? Those of you that have read my SLA story, the SLA is the CIA, where I link the FBI and the police department to Patty Hearst's kidnapping and to the activities that have been taking place since. He claims that they know where she is, but they don't bring her in because this way they can keep developing files on any other subversives. The bar received advanced knowledge of these charges from Mr. Lewis, who was born in Canada. He first started working for the FBI in 1968, and he proved that he was an FBI informer to the proper authorities by showing letters from FBI Director Clarence Kelly. Acting as an FBI undercover agent, he met Donald DeFries in San Francisco in July 1973, and at the direction of FBI Special Agent Donald L. Gray, he ordered him to meet with DeFries. Gray supposedly advised Lewis that DeFries also was an FBI informant who had turned uncontrollable, and that the LAPD had him as an agent for years and decided he was uncontrollable and then created this little army that he would be the head of. After the May 17th shootout, the other members of the SLA, five were killed besides DeFries. The others were allowed to live. He claims they were at Topanga Canyon for a while before they went up to Vegas, before they went to Pennsylvania, and the police knew they were at Topanga Canyon, and this information is available. I'll have more details on it next week from Don Freed in Los Angeles. But Mr. Gray said that he personally killed Donald DeFries. And Lake Heedley is continuing his investigation into the case with new evidence and movies of the shootout in Los Angeles. I saw them in L.A. in May, but they're news to some of the news media. The San Francisco Chronicle had an article, Walter Scott's Strange Story. This is the gentleman who phoned the proper authorities and told them this last year that his family, his brother, and his brother's wife had Pattyhearst in Pennsylvania. His information turned out to be accurate. It's interesting that Walter Scott is being made to look crazy like Martha Mitchell, like he has alcohol or mental disturbances, and all of a sudden he's ready for the funny farm, when he was able to pinpoint exactly the house where Pattyhearst was located. It was in January 31st, 1975, when an anonymous informer called the Scranton police and told them where the SLA had been located. Whether Walter Scott is an alcoholic, whether he has been in a hospital or not, is not the point. He can locate and knows where Pattyhearst was and who took her there, but the FBI could have done that and didn't want to, and he pointed it out. The one new point I want to make about Walter Scott that's very important is that Walter was a computer specialist who worked for Washington firms with government contracts, his father explained. And he had been twice divorced. He was a paid informant for the FBI and worked for various U.S. intelligence agencies. Walter Scott wants his security clearances back, and they're claiming that he dreamed up these stories to make the FBI look bad. He also has another version in the San Francisco Chronicle this week. He said that some of the things he said were a fabrication, which he dreamed up to make the FBI happy. They asked him because he had to have a clearance to do computer work, and it'd be jeopardized if he didn't come up with the right story. So on the one hand, they're making Walter Scott out as to be sick. There's an article that said mental illness and alcoholism are occupational hazards working for the government. That's funny because Dita Beard and Martha Mitchell have that hazard, and persons with information on John Kennedy's assassination and Martin Luther King's assassination. This is called an occupational hazard. That's a quotation in the Chronicle, which is true. It is an occupational hazard. If you work for government contracts, you're an informant for the FBI and U.S. intelligence, and you begin to turn over information about their investigation, it is an occupational hazard that you end up in the funny farm. They're trying to discredit Walter Scott. I don't know about his past history, how much alcohol he consumes, or what his mental state is. It was perfectly obvious that he must have gotten angry at his brother or flipped his cool or something, because he did turn over the exact house of where Pattyhearst and the Harrises were staying. The dogs confirmed it. He didn't give bad leads. And as long as they were good leads, Walter Scott is a reliable witness. It's like Martha Mitchell. Doesn't matter how much she drinks or when she drinks, if she can tell you who was out with her in California or who was with John Mitchell when the Watergate was planned, and if it can be backed up by fingerprints or evidence, her mental state earlier or afterwards has nothing to do with the evidence in the case. I think of this article of Walter Scott being in the FBI and being an informer and working for the government in U.S. intelligence agencies, because it was back in April of 74 that I wrote an article for the Berkeley Barb called "Is SLA Sin Q, the First Black Lee Harvey Oswald," in which I said that at that time that he would be killed, it would be necessary to kill him to keep the story going. And if the truth were told, what I said in this article was, if the plan to assassinate Pattyhearst is carried out, the military intelligence agencies will be stuck with something around their necks that could be as difficult to cover up as the truth about the Kennedy assassination. Evidence of a high-level conspiracy will keep cropping up again and again, and more people will be murdered. This was just before six people were murdered in Los Angeles 2 weeks later, where I charged that the Hearst kidnapping was a domestic conspiracy. So the fact that Walter Scott's background as an informant for the government and intelligence and FBI is the important thing, not the story that he drinks or has had treatment before, but that he did give information, and that we should pursue the background of these people involved in the SLA with their links to the FBI and to the government. Well, we didn't cover a lot of material. 45 minutes have gone by fast for me. I don't know about you. I'll see you next week, and we'll go into some more links of the conspiracies as this evidence begins to come out in the open. And as they destroy the physical evidence, the truth will come out in spite of the destruction. That's it for today. I'll see you next week on Dialogue Conspiracy.
has been Dialogue Conspiracy with political research specialist Mae Brussel, who for 10 years has been researching the facts behind political assassinations and conspiracies in this country. Dialogue Conspiracy originates with KELRB-FM in Carmel, California.
It's 6 o'clock, and this is...